Good afternoon. Can you all hear me back there?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for attending session 366. I'm sorry, that's the wrong script. Let me start over. Thank you for attending session 356, titled "Out of the Best Books: A Look at Some Important Books and Their Impact on Mormonism." Before we begin, I'll ask that your cell phones are turned off, so if you turn them on during the lunch hour, turn them back off now. And I will ask that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session or when considering whether to throw tomatoes. Yeah, I heard that somebody was bringing them, so actually I'm not going to let you throw them, but if you want to feed them to us, that's okay. Those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. The session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping the symposium and 40 years of respectful, thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check the bookstore in the ballroom, hosted by Benchmark Books. And I would be very remiss if I didn't remind you of that. In this session in particular, consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. The session will be 90 minutes long, and we ask that both audience and presenters keep within the time framework so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. Books have had an enormous influence on the development of Mormon history, theology, and literature. This presentation will discuss some of the most significant of them. The books will come from Mormon history, biography, doctrine, and theology, and will include works by sympathetic non-Mormon and anti-Mormon authors. Our first speaker will be Kurt Bench, who has a BA in communications from BYU and owns and operates Benchmark Books, now in its 28th year. Prior to owning the bookstore, Kurt was a store manager and fine and rare books department manager for Deseret Book Company. He's the author of many books and articles, including 50 Important Mormon Books from Sunstone, October 1990. So I've been doing this a while. Greg Coford is an MIT grad and Wall Street investor, the former president and CEO of Siegel Books, and current president and CEO of Coford Books. And after the presenter and the respondent have presented their materials, we'll have a Q&A. And when we do that, I'll ask you to come up, speak into the microphone so that it can be recorded well, it's not tape, but whatever digital media they use to record now.
I know it must be a shock for you to see that I'm going to talk about books. Usually Sunstone invites true scholars or otherwise really smart people to discourse on a variety of esoteric subjects, theological and otherwise. But when considering me, someone asked, "Does Bench know much about anything important at all?" And that anything that anyone would be interested in. And someone else offered, "I think the only thing he knows anything about is books, so let's let him talk about books. What harm could he do?" Well, we'll see. I am an unrepentant, habitual, confirmed bibliophile. I'm not talking about being in love with a machine, a Bindle or Rook or whatever the heck they're called. I'm talking about one of the greatest inventions and loveliest creations done by the hands and minds of human beings, a set of sheets of paper with words printed with real ink, sewn together, preferably, but glued, if necessary, and then bound together in order to be held, read, and treasured. It's called a book. I delight in and identify with Thomas Jefferson's words, "I cannot live without books." Desiderius Erasmus reflects my philosophy perfectly. When I get a little money, I buy books, and if any is left, I buy food and clothes. Can any of you relate to that here? Cicero's wisdom is obvious. A room without books is like a body without soul. Now, curious how many wives in here would go along with that. Mine does not. You're wondering if this will be an infomercial or an erudite treatise on the intrinsic value of literature and its impact on civilization in general and Mormonism in particular. The answer is yes. I will shamelessly promote books and point you to our book exhibit down the hall and tell you to browse the dozens of book tables with many hundreds of books for sale and purchase as many as you can carry. Believe it or not, this does not just help us keep our doors open, but it has a direct benefit to Sunstone as well. We've been book partners and supporters of Sunstone for many years. In fact, many of you probably wouldn't believe this, but when I worked for Deseret Book for a couple of years, I even talked them into letting me represent us at Sunstone in those early days. That changed after a short time. They didn't think it would be such a good idea. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Usually I don't have trouble being heard. But I do also want to inform you about some important books from Mormon history and reveal to some extent how they have impacted our religion. Books have had an enormous influence on the development of Mormon history, theology, and literature. In this presentation, I will discuss just a handful of those. You may never have thought of this, but if it weren't for books, you and I probably would not be here today. If there were no Bible, there would probably be no Judaism or Christianity either, or Islam, at least in the form we know them. There would have been no James 1:5 for Joseph Smith to read and receive inspiration to seek answers from God about his personal forgiveness of sins, his salvation, which church was true. If Joseph did not produce any of the printed words in periodicals or books, such as The Evening and the Morning Star, Times and Seasons, the Book of Mormon, Book of Commandments, the Doctrine and Covenants, Mormonism might not have survived, let alone thrived and expanded dramatically over time. Our ancestors may not have joined Joseph Smith's fledgling church, and we wouldn't be here today, at least as Mormons. There probably wouldn't even be a Sunstone Symposium. However, even worse than all that, I wouldn't have a livelihood and a book collection that bring me not only a modicum of income, but great happiness and contentment. I would not be happy owning Benchmark Bakery or Benchmark Bicycles. You get the point, which is that the great and even the unknown have produced books, most of which are soon forgotten, but some of which stand the test of time and have enormous impact on human life and history. Think of a world without scripture and other sacred writings of the world's many religious traditions, such as the Analects of Confucius, which none of you have read. No, there might be one or two. The Republic by Plato, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, Shakespeare's First Folio, Darwin's Origin of Species, Common Sense by Thomas Paine, War and Peace by Tolstoy, Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Woman, or even that book's modern Mormon equivalent, Fascinating Womanhood, by Helen Andlin, our modern-day Mary Wollstonecraft, Simone de Beauvoir, and Germaine Greer all rolled into one. I knew Nadine would like that one. As with most of the printed word throughout history, the majority of LDS books do not leave much of a mark and are forgotten after a generation, if that long. After all, how many recall Parley P. Pratt's "A Short Account of a Shameful Outrage Committed by a Part of the Inhabitants of the Town of Mentor Upon the Person of Elder Parley P. Pratt," published in 1835, or the strange 1904 title, yeah, you remember it, the strange title, "Uncle Bob and Aunt Becky's Strange Adventures at the World's Great Exposition." It's actually a Mormon book. And the best, to be forgotten, "The Natchez Origin of the Black and Mixed Races. Negroes are not the children of Adam. Their status of creation is that of subjects. Negro slavery was instituted by divine authority at the creation of man. Adam was created for dominion, and the Negro was made slave in the Garden of Eden." That's the title of a Mormon book published in 1860. It was a great year, wasn't it, for literature? As with many faith traditions, books have had an enormous influence on the development of Mormonism as it is perceived by its members as well as those outside the faith. Perhaps one could argue that our great books are not equal with those of the world in general, or that Mormons may or may not have their own Shakespeare's, Milton's, Newton's, Tolstoy's. However one may perceive the quality of written works of Mormon authors, past and present, the fact remains that some of them have shaped Mormonism in varied, significant, and perhaps permanent ways. I will examine here a handful that I think have met that standard. I've chosen to discuss only printed books, not periodicals, such as some of those that I mentioned earlier, early church periodicals, or later ones, the Improvement Era, Relief Society Magazine, Ensign, independent publications such as Dialogue, BYU Studies, and Sunstone, and conspicuously absent from this talk are what would arguably be the most important Mormon books, and that is the Four Standard Works. Those are obvious. The idea of deciding which Mormon books are important is perhaps presumptuous, certainly difficult, clearly subjective, but I hope useful and interesting. By important, I generally mean the work has had significant impact on or a major contribution in one or more of the five categories I selected for an article that Nadine mentioned that I did for Sunstone in 1990. And I have copies of that article for whoever would like them. Called it 50 Important Mormon Books. The categories are history and biography, doctrine and theology, anti-Mormon, and books by sympathetic and non-Mormon authors, also literature, but I am only taking on three of those in this particular talk today. Important does not necessarily mean best or even the most well-written book, nor the most informative or inspiring. These books have all had a significant influence on Mormon culture or the LDS Church itself. Many have had a great effect on the development of Mormon historiography, theology, or literature over a sustained period of time. It is difficult to gauge or quantify influence or impact, but I looked at such criteria as the number of titles or editions, including reprints of those titles by given authors, at least a general idea of sales figures, area of distribution, what the size of the church was and the general population at the time, use of or references to the author's materials within and outside the church, and for how long after publication, and the amount of time the books have remained in print, and also the demand for them after going out of print. And such data, of course, are really hard to gather, and I have not attempted to make an exhaustive study of that. Okay. I'm going to just talk about a half dozen books, one or two from three of the categories that I mentioned. And one or two of them are even what I call banned books in Zion. Having trouble hearing still? Have you turned up your bell tone? Okay, sorry. The first one and these are in chronological order within the category, Biographical Sketches of Joseph Smith and His Progenitors, which was published in 1855, written by Lucy Smith, who worked on her reminiscences during the 1840s, and it's a fascinating story that I don't have time to tell you about the dictation and how that manuscript worked and how it got into the hands of Orson Pratt, who did purchase it. And in 1852, Pratt wrote to Brigham Young saying that he intended to publish another work which will be very interesting, namely The Narrative of Mother Smith. Now keep in mind, he did write Brigham Young in 1852 because Brigham Young seemed to have forgotten that. Pratt subsequently announced that the manuscript would be published in Liverpool, mistakenly saying that originally it was written by the direction and under inspection of the prophet, which it was not. It was published in an edition of 10,000 copies, which is a lot, many of which were left unbound, and as it turned out, unsold as well. It didn't help sales when Brigham Young wrote in the Millennial Star, excuse me, that there are many mistakes in the work, noting that these life sketches should be carefully corrected. After finding out about the massive amounts of tracts and books left unsold in the Millennial Star office, Brigham Young gave instructions on how to deal with them, including biographical sketches specifically. I wish you to gather up from the saints all the copies you can of the history of Joseph Smith the prophet, said to have been written by Mother Smith and printed by O. Pratt, and have them with those in the office and such tracts as are incorrect in doctrine destroyed. Provided you cannot sell them to a papermaker with the privilege of seeing them all thrown into the vat or otherwise rendered unfit to read. Despite the destruction of many of the books, nearly 4,000 had been distributed and continued to find their way among the saints. At one point, Brigham Young called the book a tissue of falsehoods and accused Pratt of not getting prior approval from him or the other church leaders before publishing it. In 1865, Brigham Young told a congregation in Wellsville, I require the 12, the high priest, the 70s, the bishops, and everyone in the church, male and female, if they have such a book, to destroy it. If they do not, the responsibility of the evil results that may accrue from keeping it will rest upon them and not upon me. If the saints who bought the book turned it over to their bishop and wanted reimbursement, they could get it. I want to make clear the Benchmark Books does not have that same policy. If you don't like the book, give it away. Brigham Young had also criticized Pratt for some of his other published writings, including The Seer, The Holy Spirit, and The Great First Cause. Why did he disapprove so vehemently of this book? There are a number of reasons and speculations. One of the big ones being that he felt that William Smith, Joseph's brother, was dealt with far too favorably by his mother in the book. And also, Jan Shipps thought that because the book was so familial and, you know, family-oriented, and now the reorganization was coming into being, that some felt that it was endorsing the reorganization, which Brigham Young, of course, did not approve of. But it continually rankled Brigham Young that his recollection was that Pratt had never asked for his permission to publish the biography, and some even felt it was church property. Young's concerns over the false statements, Lucy's faulty memory, and other problems did not seem to take priority in the controversy. He appointed Wilford Woodruff, George A. Smith, and Elias Smith to produce an apparently extensively revised and corrected version of the book. And that book was published in 1902, and had surprisingly few changes. Certainly not very many substantive ones. And then it went through a variety of editions after that and has remained in print most of the time since its original publication in 1853. Richard Lloyd Anderson calls the Lucy Smith book one of, quote, the essential sources for Mormon origins. Irene Bates points out that the book is important because we are given a picture of Lucy's early life as well as a description of her own crucial role in the Mormon Restoration, and adds, she gives us a firsthand account of the whole family's involvement in the restoration of the LDS Church and in the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Our official histories are enriched because of her efforts. Let me see how I'm doing here. Second, I guess we kind of need to fast forward about 100 years to 1945, a completely different kind of biography of Joseph Smith. And this was Fawn McKay Brody's No Man Knows My History, The Life of Joseph Smith the Prophet. As you recall, Fawn Brody was Thomas McKay's daughter and David O. McKay's niece. And her mother was Fawn Brimhall McKay, who was a very strong personality in her own right. This was the first biography of the church's founder written by an insider with a naturalistic perspective. Presciently, an early reviewer, Herbert Breyer, predicted that the book would probably be one of the most highly praised as well as highly condemned historical works of 1945. The New York Times called it one of the best of all Mormon books, scholarly, comprehensive, and judicial, scrupulously objective. Newsweek called it a definitive biography in the fullest sense of the word. It received a lot of praise, but as you would expect, since this hit so close to home for so many Mormons, it also received a fair amount of condemnation. At first, the church, through its official organ, the Deseret News, was silent. In fact, it wasn't until the third printing of the book that the church-owned Deseret News, the Church News, published a critique of the book. But before that, Apostle John A. Widtsoe in the Improvement Era wrote, "The purported history of Joseph Smith is really an attempt to portray Joseph Smith as a deceiver, a dishonest man who knew he was acting out a lie." And he condemned her unfairness and said that she had a venomous temper, which came out in the book. And as a history of Joseph Smith, the book is a flat failure. It will be of no interest to Latter-day Saints who have a correct knowledge of the history of Joseph Smith. Then the Deseret News had a committee that reviewed the book, and it was attacked as wholly atheistic and reduced it to the level of a novel, not a book of history, and characterized it as a composite of all anti-Mormon books that have gone before, pieced into a pattern conformable to the author's own particular rationale and bedded in some very bad psychology. And then next came Hugh Nibley with No Ma'am, That's Not History. He was easier on her than some, and he did allow that the book was not animated by violent hatred. Brody took a beating from many in the church, including some in her own family. An uncle, I've got to share this one, sent a message to Fawn through Madeline McCune, who had known Brody for years. He noted, McCune noted from Merrill, "I have a little message from the church via Dr. Morrill that she, Brody, had better stay the hell out of Utah from now on." And then McCune opined, "What do they think they could do to her? Call out the Danites?" What they did was to excommunicate her for apostasy And David O. McKay, her uncle and president of the church, seems to have had a significant role in that action. The book went on to become a solid-selling book, was in hardback for 50 years before being reprinted in paperback. It has never gone out of print in its 70 years of publication. Just a little personal anecdote. When I worked at Deseret Book many years ago, we could not put that book on the shelf, but at least at the downtown store where I was, if someone wanted to special order the book, we would go take a few minutes and go in the back room and get a copy and bring it out and produce an instant special order.
Because of where you're at, was it okay, though, when you were in the used bookstore, when you were in the used, could you sell it there as a used book, or did you still have that same policy?
And see, we have a member of the audience who thinks it's the Q&A right now. Sure, Joe, we're good buddies. That was when I was selling. I was in the rare book department then, but we sold new and used, and it was new books. So we actually had to order it from the publisher or distributor, and had a little stack of them in the back. You didn't hear that from me, by the way. Newell Bringhurst, Brody's biographer, noting some of the ambivalence about her book by Mormon writers, and despite the appearance of several book-length studies on Joseph Smith, writes, "No Man Knows My History has continued to enjoy a high degree of respect among scholars in the general field of American religious history. It continues to be, by default, the closest thing to a definitive biography of the Mormon leader." Sterling McMurrin proclaimed that the book represented, quote, "a watershed in the treatment of Mormon history by Mormon historians, because in its wake, Mormon history produced by Mormon scholars moved toward more openness, objectivity, and honesty." Kent Walgren, who actually put together, he was a book dealer, friend of mine, put together his own list of important books, along with Price Guide, said this about that book, "Whatever one's opinion of the merits of No Man Knows My History, it is probably the most influential book printed about the Mormons in the 20th century. 10 years ago, another biography of Joseph Smith was published by the same publisher that did Brody's book 60 years previously. Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling by Richard L. Bushman and ably assisted by Jed Woodworth. I'm not including it in my list here, although I believe I could. We'll give it some more time and see where it falls in place in the list of important books, but I believe it's going to be right up there, and with many it already is. Terrell Givens calls it clearly the definitive biography for generations to come and the most balanced, thorough, and insightful treatment to date. Truly a masterful work. There's a number of other accolades for that book as well, but since I'm not going to be discussing that one specifically, I'll pass on those. Another thing that I want to mention that's not part of my list but I think will become tremendously important in Mormon historiography and Mormon studies, and that is the Joseph Smith Papers Project, done under the auspices of the LDS Church. I believe it will prove to be one of the most significant and influential bodies of research and history to ever be produced by anyone. John Turner describes the papers, including the wealth of resources on the project's website, as, quote, "already the single most valuable resource for students of early history, Mormonism. For their attention to detail, for their abundant citation of other primary sources, for the lavish inclusion of photographs and maps, for their contextualization of Smith's prophetic career, the Joseph Smith Papers are indeed a great and marvelous work." Number three, The Mountain Meadows Massacre by Juanita Brooks, published only 5 years after Fawn Brody's book. By 1950, it had been a generation since much of substance had been written about the darkest chapter in Mormon history, and that is the Mountain Meadows Massacre, the slaughter of 120 Arkansan immigrants going through southern Utah on their way to California. The subject was taboo in the church, especially in southern Utah, where many of the descendants of the participants still lived. Juanita Brooks, a local historian in St. George, tackled the forbidden topic and produced a book that sent shockwaves through the church and around the country. The Mountain Meadows Massacre, published by Stanford University Press in 1950, addressed the history of that dark event in an objective, non-polemical way that was never done before. Brooks writes in the book's preface, "This study is not designed either to smear or to clear any individual. Its purpose is to present the truth. I feel sure that nothing but the truth can be good enough for the church to which I belong." As with any book about a controversial subject, reviews were mixed, non-Mormon critics being much more positive, sometimes even laudatory, than their LDS counterparts. The San Francisco Examiner called it an absorbing and dramatic story. The Oregonian said the book was a carefully done study with extensive appendices and immense bibliography and should be welcomed by all, Mormon or not, as an important contribution to an understanding of a West that now seems as remote as the Dark Ages. Dale Morgan said he was putting the book among his most cherished books in his library and predicted that its objectivity and thoroughness would influence the course of Mormon historiography. The book was later revised and went through 9 printings in hardback before being issued in paperback in 1991. And in that edition, Jan Shipps wrote in the foreword, "Rarely in the writing of the history of any controversial or tragic event has a single historical work had such a far-reaching impact as has Mountain Meadows Massacre. Rarely, too, has any historical monograph stood the test of time so well." There have been numerous works on the massacre since Brooks's book was published, and many are of the highest quality. However, many still feel that Juanita Brooks has written the best book on the subject, the standard by which all other books are measured, and the foundation upon which they are built. Under the category of doctrine and theology, A Voice of Warning by Parley P. Pratt, published in 1837. Pratt had moved out of the contentious Kirtland to New York City on a mission with his new wife, not sure what number. Converts were scarce, so he spent his time researching and writing and wrote what turned out to be, in Terrell Givens and Matthew Groh's estimation, as, quote, "the most influential book written by a Mormon in the 19th century." It was a 216-page treatise, which he gave the title of Voice of Warning and Instruction, published in an edition in New York of 3,000 copies. Those authors I just mentioned write, "Pratt's book would soon become the principal vehicle presenting Mormonism to the Latter-day Saint faithful and general public alike. It was elevated by both to near canonical status." Peter Crawley writes, "Voice of Warning was not quite the first Mormon missionary tract or the first outline of the tenets of the Latter-day Saints, but it was first to emphasize the differences between Mormonism and Orthodox Christianity. It established a formula for describing the church's basic doctrines, and it included biblical proof texts, arguments, and examples which would be used by Mormon pamphleteers for 100 years. It would also be an extremely effective missionary tract, and before the close of the century, it would go through more than 30 editions in English and then be translated into Danish, Dutch, French, German, Icelandic, Spanish, and Swedish. There have been at least 80 known printings of A Voice of Warning since its publication in 1837 and is still in print today." In fact, when I went on my mission in 1921, the book was still included in the mission library. We were required to read it. And in our mission, the rule was you read through the entire mission library twice and then you could read whatever you wanted. So that's when I started my book collection. Now let's go ahead to a little later in the mid-20th century. in the same category of theology and doctrine. Sorry, I got to speed it up. Mormon Doctrine, published in 1958, Salt Lake City, by Bookcraft. As you recall, Bruce R. McConkie was Joseph Fielding Smith's son-in-law and protege. He was a member of the First Council of 70. He wrote this nearly 800-page tome, which the preface declares is unique, the first of its kind ever published. It is the first major attempt to digest, explain, and analyze all of the important doctrines of the kingdom. It is the first extensive compendium of the whole gospel, the first attempt to publish an encyclopedic commentary covering the whole field of revealed religion. Does that leave anything out? By any standard, this is a landmark book. Never before has a book authored by any Mormon, especially a general authority, covered so many gospel topics in so much detail and with so much authoritativeness and specificity. Besides the standard works, there are few, if any, books that have been referred to or quoted as often. For over 50 years, when an average church member wanted to research any subject, however obscure or well-known, he or she turned to the encyclopedic Mormon Doctrine. Despite the author's obligatory assumption of, quote, full and sole responsibility for the contents of the book, thereby disclaiming any official church authorization or connection, many saints nevertheless use it as if it were the fifth standard work. President David O. McKay was concerned because in the minds of the general authorities and in their individual capacities cannot be separated from them in official capacities. He then directed two prominent senior apostles to go through the entire book and make corrections, see what needed to be corrected. And then they were originally going to send out an addendum to all the church members who had bought it to correct the errors. And they found 1,067 items specifically that needed correction. That did not happen as far as sending out the addendum, but McKay recorded in his diary, "It was agreed that the necessary corrections are so numerous that to republish a corrected edition of the book would be such an extensive repudiation of the original as to destroy the credit of the author, that the republication of the book should be forbidden, and that the book should be repudiated in such a way as to save the career of the author as one of the general authorities of the church." The decision was made to not republish the book, and in the future, all general authorities would have to seek permission of the first presidency before they could publish a book. This McConkie had not done. And then they had to inform his father-in-law and then him that this was going to happen. He agreed. They agreed to all of that. And yet, it was only 8 years later, despite the decision to not republish the book, that McConkie's book in a revised edition was published. He had gone to President McKay earlier on, who at this time was 92 and feeble, and asked if he could redo the book, and was told that should the book be republished at this time, McConkie would be responsible for it and it would not be a church publication. McConkie took that to mean he had the go-ahead to publish a new edition and did just that. Greg Prince writes, "The book became one of the all-time bestsellers in Mormondom, achieving the near-canonical status that McKay had fought unsuccessfully to avoid, and setting a tone of doctrinal fundamentalism antithetical to McKay's personal philosophy that remains a legacy of the church to this day." It's interesting to note that 5 years ago, over 50 years after the publication of Mormon Doctrine, the book quietly went out of print. The reason given by the publisher was because of low sales and the demand is no longer there. Also, just recently we learned of the similar passing of another Mormon classic, The Miracle of Forgiveness, another controversial book that has now been allowed to go out of print or is in the process. Okay, getting there. The final category that I'm doing is anti-Mormon. Mormonism Unveiled by Eber D. Howe, published in Painesville, Ohio, 1834. It was written only 4 years after the church was organized. It's one of the earliest and certainly the major anti-Mormon work of the 19th century. It is considered to be the father or progenitor of most of the substantive anti-Mormon books of the 19th and 20th centuries. B.H. Roberts called it the chief source of information for all anti-Mormon publications which have followed it. Eber D. Howe owned the Painesville Telegraph. He became interested in this new sect of Mormonism. He was very irritated when his wife and I believe daughter joined the church. He became acquainted with Dr. Philastus Hurlbut. And doctor is his given name, not his title, who had joined the church and ended up getting in trouble and was excommunicated twice. He became quite embittered, and he began to gather affidavits as to the negative character of the Smith family and others, and eventually Howe enjoined him to do research for him, to gather more affidavits, and to talked to residents who had known the Smiths in the different areas where they had lived, especially in New York. Also to look into the Solomon Spaulding connection, which Howe includes in his book, but of course that manuscript was later found, and that theory of the connection between the Spaulding manuscript and the Book of Mormon has largely been discredited. Some of the affidavits charged the Smiths with intemperance and money digging, and saying they neglected their farms while involved in these pursuits. At any rate, the book was published in 1834. In its 19 chapters, it includes a summary of those affidavits. It also provides an account of how the Book of Mormon came to be. Draws on Alexander Campbell's expose of the Mormons in his pamphlet called Delusions. And again, it talked about the Spaulding manuscript. Howe's book was quickly denounced by Smith's followers. Oliver Cowdery said the book originated with the father of lies. Smith and others accused Philastus Hurlbut of being the real author of the book. However, Dan Vogel shows that Hurlbut was only a researcher, not a writer, and of the 290 pages, his research occupied only 40 pages. Mormonism Unveiled was reprinted a few times in the 19th and 20th centuries and has now been published in a critical annotated edition edited by Dan Vogel and published by Signature Books. It is doubtful that an overwhelming number of copies of the book ever circulated, but the fact that the basic arguments and documentation were adopted by so many writers over more than 100 years, the book lived on and has had an enormous influence on anti-Mormon literature that remains to this day. Hey, well, I've shared briefly, at least it seemed that way to me, a half dozen books from the most positive, even apologetic, to the most acerbic, from among the thousands that have been published since the 1830s, but more specifically from my list of 50 important Mormon books. Individually and collectively, they have had an enormous influence on the development of Mormon history and thought. Without all these writers, thinkers, and movers, and the printed word that they produced, we would have a very different Mormonism today, if we had one at all. Thank you.
I grew up in Mormon publishing. My family used to own Covenant and Siegel Book, which at the time were the number two player in the market. They were the number two publisher and the number two retailer, with Deseret Book being the number one in both those categories. The family ended up selling both those enterprises to Deseret Book. But as a result of growing up in that experience and running Siegel Book for a while, I was asked to be on a panel a couple years ago on Mormon publishing here at Sunstone. And I told, amongst talking about how to get your book published and things like that, I told a number of stories about Deseret Book and the battles that we had gone through as their largest customer and also their largest competitor. Session ended up being widely circulated amongst Deseret Book employees at the time, but I don't think this one is going to reach that status. So, but in thinking about the experience in retailing and specifically retailing books, and I need to make that distinction because if you've been in a LDS bookstore lately, they actually have morphed into LDS gift shops, to the point where some of them don't even have as many books as they have trinkets and t-shirts and pictures anymore. But it's interesting when you think about it. At its peak, the LDS Booksellers Association had about 450 retail members. So these would be stores that were part of the association. Today, the association has 120 members approximately. But that number is even misleading because Deseret Book has signed up each one of its retail stores as an individual member so that they can have enough votes to control the organization. So LDS retailing has changed dramatically in the last 20 years, and that has impacted the types of books that are being published. And I just wanted to kind of throw that in as a background as we talk about great books and their availability. About 7 years ago, my oldest daughter took off to California to attend college at Chapman University in the shadow of Disneyland. And while she was there, she decided to take an atheism class. And in that her professor was a Dr. Carmichael Peters, who also ran the, and does today run the honors department at Chapman University. And one day, Professor Peters asked Whitney if she would stay after class for a couple minutes. And Whitney agreed. After class, Dr. Peters told Whitney, he said, I kind of sense from some of the comments you make in class, some of the questions that you ask, that you come from a religious family. But I can't quite pin down what religion it is. And I was wondering if you'd share that with me. And Whitney says, sure, I come from a Mormon family. But she said, it's not a typical Mormon family. And Carmichael said, well, what do you mean by that? She says, well, it's my dad. She said, he'll be sitting there at breakfast reading the paper, and there'll be a story about some new scientific discovery. And so then we have to have a family discussion about the theological implications of the scientific discovery. He's always made sure that we knew about the oddities and the quirks in our religious history. He's always having discussions about if you push the theology out to a certain point, does it break or are there inconsistencies in it? She said, to give you an idea what my life has been like in a language you can understand, I started debating theodicy at the age of 8. Dr. Carmichael told her that that wasn't typical, not for just Mormonism, but it wasn't typical for any religious family. And he said, I sympathize with you, but if your dad's ever in California, I'd like to meet him. So I did go meet with Dr. Peters. We went to breakfast one Saturday morning. And he confessed to me that he'd never taken Mormonism seriously as a religion worth study. And I told him that I understood that from the perspective that we as a religion, as Mormon studies writers and publishers, had not yet produced works that were forcing the academy to engage with us. I said, we're having some success in history, but the rest were not. Largely what we published to that point had by and large been polemical type stuff, and you're not going to take that seriously. So I explained to him that one of the missions of Greg Hofert Books, and the reason I started it, was to try to produce books that would cause the academy on a larger scale to engage with Mormonism. That was further echoed at the National Book Convention in New York when I was there a month or so ago. In talking with different distributors, because we're trying to find a larger distributor for Greg Hovard books, about the concept that nobody has a problem walking into a bookstore and there's a bookshelf or at least a fair number of books on Jewish studies, but there may be one or two books on Mormon studies if you're outside Happy Valley. And I'd explain to him the population numbers are very similar, demographics and income and wealth and education are very similar, and they're starting to kind of catch on. So it is moving in that direction. So as we think about what makes a great book, and the books that Kurt mentioned, I do agree with, those are great books. I don't think we're going to have any problem with Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, passing the test of time. In fact, I personally would have put it on the list today. The Papers Project, I also agree that is a game changer in terms of historical studies, and that certainly is worthy of being on the list as well. So as we think about what makes a great book great, I'm going to rely on the definition of game changer. It changes the discussion in a significant way. And we have to do that because we can't rely upon quantity of books sold, because the quantity of books that we're dealing with in this arena is minuscule compared to publishing at large. To put it into perspective, a good Mormon romance novel these days will have an initial print run of 60, 70,000 copies. That's the initial print run. The Joseph Smith Papers Project, this is the foundational papers of our religion. Deseret Book was hesitant to do an initial print run of 10,000 copies, and after the first volume has struggled to sell 10,000 copies. So that, to put it into perspective. The best seller that we've ever had at Greg Hofford Books was the authorized biography that we published of Hugh Nibley. And we're just about out of the second printing of that book, which means we'll have then sold 8,000 copies. So to put it into perspective, we're not talking large numbers of books sold that end up changing the discussion. What I look for in books when we consider to publish, because I've always, you always want to be publishing great books as a publisher. But one of the things that I'm always looking for is, does the manuscript that's being submitted to us actually have elements that are not just worth publishing, but are going to change that discussion? As an example, we recently had a manuscript submitted for the second time that covers a particular point in LDS history. Well written, had a lot of footnotes, easy to read. But the problem with the book is it did not add a single thing that you couldn't find in the documentary history of the church. It was better written than documentary history of the church and far better footnoted, but it added nothing new, so we passed on the manuscript. So that's one of the things that we're looking for in game-changing books. Some of the recent, and by recent I'm talking the last 20, 30 years, books that have been published, and this is by no means exhaustive, it's just some titles that I think have had significant changes in the discussion about Mormonism. For example, D. Michael Quinn's Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, I think significantly changed the discussion about early Mormon history. And I think that book is going to bear the test of time, although the average Mormon has never heard of it, but it has changed the discussion significantly. Another book that I think is in the process of changing the discussion, and this one I have to confess, I'm biased because we published it, but Brian Hell's Joseph Smith Polygamy, the 3-volume set, has significantly changed the discussion on polygamy in the church. Even if you don't agree with Brian's assumptions, and again, Brian, takes full responsibility for those, it has changed that discussion. The other thing that I'm always thinking about on the game-changing aspect of books is we're always talking about books published in English. And we've hit a point, obviously, in our church where English is not the dominant language anymore. And even if you look just at activity numbers, and I kind of back into this backhandedly, because obviously the church doesn't tell us how many people are active. But if you look at the number of wards around the world, the U.S. has slightly more wards, but external to the U.S. you have the majority of the branches. And if you do some conservative numbers on average people attending on a ward basis, and you got to use the ward and branch because stakes and districts are wildly different in their size. For example, there are 15 stakes that have more than 13 wards in them, with the winning stake being the Wasilla Alaska stake with 15 wards. 49 stakes have four or fewer wards, with the smallest being the Sioux City, Iowa stake with 3 wards. And districts vary widely from 2 to 13 branches. But if you just kind of back the envelope numbers there, we're at a point where non-U.S. membership is as significant as the U.S. membership. And most of the non-U.S. membership, English is not the native language. And yet none of the books other than No Man Knows My History and Voice of Warning and Mormon Doctrine on Perch List have been published in any language other than English. Mormon Doctrine was done in Spanish briefly in the early 90s, but it went quickly out of print. As Kurt mentioned, Voice of Warning has been through 7 languages, 7 language translation, and I believe No Man Knows My History has been done in 2 additional languages. But the larger church, I think we're hitting a point in our history where we need to be cognizant that the discussion needs to be more embracive, inclusive. And Cynthia and I, my wife and I, just got back from a vacation in Cambodia. And while we were there, we attended church with a local Cambodian unit. And those guys could care less about any of the things we're talking about today. You know, this is a country where the average monthly income is $100 to $150. So it's a struggle for them to buy a Book of Mormon for $2. So, the foundational, the important works for them are just getting scriptures in the home. So we need to be cognizant of that. But as we think about the great books that need to be written, as I mentioned, we've done pretty well in the category of history. And we've hit a point where PhD students can write dissertations about Mormon history, and their advisor's not going to say, oh, don't do that, because you'll never get a job. Students doing theology, religious studies, sociology, still hear that on occasion from advisors. Oh, don't do a Mormon topic, you'll have a tough time getting a job. And yet they're not telling kids, don't do a thesis on Catholicism, don't do a thesis on Judaism. And that's, again, circling back, that's something that we need to do. We need to publish the books that the Academy is going to be forced to engage with. And those are starting to come out. And you're seeing that from, publishers like us, Signature, the university presses, are putting out books that the Academy more and more is having to engage with. And is causing us to broaden out the definition of what is going to be a great book. And hopefully in the future, when this panel is happening in 50 years from now, we're not limited to just history, biography, theology, doctrine, anti-Mormon, but we're having books on sociology and religious studies and those kind of things. And I think that's happening, and I think we're moving in the right direction. So appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay, we can now do our Q&A. I would like you to come up and ask your questions up here so that your questions will be on the tape. And I'm going to ask the first question. I was thinking about what you were just saying. I'd like to hear some examples of books that you say might be coming out or in the pipeline of books that would engage uh, academic studies or what we were just talking about just now. And then I was wondering if Armin Moss's book about the, it's something in the beehive, what is it?
Angel.
The Angel in the Beehive, if you would consider that one of those books, one of those kinds of books. Either one of you. It might not be turned on. Just there's a switch. I think. Probably easier just come here.
some of the types of books that are coming out and being published, you've got books. There's a number of books that are coming out or have come out or are coming out on women and the church and how they're interacting and how they need to interact. One of the competing sessions right now is talking about a book we published, Women at Church. And Signature just came out with a book. Oxford's about to come out with a book. So there are a number of books being published on that, and I think that is an issue. I can't tell you which one is the winner or whatever, but that's certainly a significant issue for half the membership of the church, at a minimum. And that relationship of women with the church is, I think, in the process of being redefined. And so I think books about that will have furthered the discussion and will continue to further the discussion. There's a number of books that have been published about scriptures and our relationship to them. One of the series that we're publishing is about the Mormon engagement with the scripture. And there's been a number of those titles that have gotten some quite a significant review or two in the larger academic arena, and so are causing engagement there. As far as Armin Moss's book, we're starting to see more books come out about the church, about the modern church. Up until recently, kind of the only book that was out there was Tom Alexander's
Mormonism in Transition.
Yeah, Mormonism in Transition, which I should know because we publish it, but in my old age I'm getting frail. So so there's a number of books that Greg Prince's that Kirk mentioned about the David O. McKayer. There's a number of books that are being published on the modern church that are helping us to understand what's going on and putting things in a broader perspective. And we're also starting to see significant scholarly works being published on the international church. One of our publications, Marjorie Newton's Mormon in Maori, just won Best International Book at MHA, and takes a good, honest look at our interaction with those people. And, you know, there's some things that are uncomfortable that happened, but those discussions need to be had so that we can learn from it and grow. As a group and as a people.
You know, this is an embarrassment meeting, but I thought you were directing it to Greg, so I sort of tuned out the first part of your question. Were you asking?
Well, it kind of was directed to him because he had brought up the subject right at the end of his talk, but I'd be happy to have your input too. But it was what kinds of books might be in the pipeline that would engage the larger community, the academic community.
Well, I think he answered it well. I want to actually, and I didn't plan to do this just because Greg was here, but I want to highly recommend a book that Greg Fokker just published. It's called This Is My Doctrine by Charles Carroll. In my mind, it's the best single treatise on the development, revolution, or whatever you want to call it, doctrine that's ever been written between the covers one book covers every conceivable idea or doctrine that's ever been taught in the church, basically. And it looks at contemporary sources, what Joseph and his contemporaries said about it, or what the Bible says, Bible scholars, others. I think it's a very important contribution, and certainly, I mean, but in terms of, is it important in using the criteria that I use, I think it's very important personally, but as with most of these kinds of books, there's, you know, 118 people out there that are even aware of a lot of these books. So that's the sad part, that there just isn't much distribution to a wide audience, just because the wide audience is not interested. But there are some fine books coming. Some people I know are very cynical and pessimistic about the future of Mormon studies. I'm very optimistic, well, guardedly optimistic, but I think that there's a generation of scholars coming up through the ranks now that are producing scholarship that is head and shoulders above a lot of what we saw in the first 150 years of Mormonism. They're bright, they're motivated, they are very good writers for the most part, and I really think, as I said, the Joseph Smith Papers Project is going to have a ripple effect that will continue for generations to come because of the openness, because of the use of the sources and the freedom that the editors have been given to open up the record and open up all of Joseph Smith's papers. Tremendously important. By the way, before I forget, if you wanted a copy of my article, if there weren't enough, we have more at our book table. Go down to the book table.
Okay.
Thank you. Just fun story about Charlie's book that Kirk mentioned. Charlie's a professor down at BYU and circulated his manuscript to a number of buddies on campus and ended up on the desk of the Dean of Academic Advising, who called Charlie and told him if the book was published, he would be fired. Charlie worked on tweaking the manuscript a bit, felt like he had achieved a spirit that tone in the book that would be more amenable to the Dean of Academic Advising. Again, told, no, if this book gets published, you'll get fired. Meanwhile, we're moving ahead with the editing and the typesetting. We got to the point where we were going to go to press. So I called Charlie up and said, hey, we need to go to lunch. So we met for lunch, and I told him, look, I'm about to order this print run, and I need to make sure you're good on us publishing this. Once I spend $20,000-$25,000 printing the book, I can't even have to ring me up and say, hey, can you not sell the book because of this pressure? He said, no, we're okay going ahead with it. He said, my retirement secure is vested, there's nothing to do about that. I'd like to keep teaching for a few more years, but if they want to be stupid and take that away, both my wife and I are comfortable with that. I said, well, the really important question is, if they're stupid enough to fire you over the book, can I use that to sell more copies? And Charlie said, yeah, for that, don't do that. Now, we ended up getting Desert Book to carry the book, and you can get it at Desert Book today, on the square.
Strike the first part of that.
But I bring that up because, by virtue of the fact that the church-owned retailer was carrying it, that ended the discussion of why Charlie.
And which book was this? Go ahead.
This is My Doctrine.
This is My Doctrine. Okay.
By Charles Harrell.
Okay. Awesome.
Thank you, Nadine. Kurt, you touched upon it. The four of us have joked before that there's only six of us out there that read these books. So I think to get to the heart of it, we had Jesus the Christ by Talmage, Voice of Warning by Pratt, McConkie's Mormon Doctrine. It's going to take something from a general authority to actually make an impact. Do you see any books that have been done in the last 20 years to replace Mormon Doctrine or by a general authority, or do you see anything in any general authorities coming up who you see that may be able to replace that.
Well, I'm probably letting the cat out of the bag, but when Kurt's called me to do a possible, I think we'll be on the right track.
Thanks a lot for the confidentiality.
And do we even want another book to replace Mormon Doctrine?
Yeah.
Well, I think for you,
you can go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think most general authorities would never attempt it after what happened to Swami Kanti and that book. There have been some other attempts in encyclopedic works similar, but nothing even comes close to the impact or the numbers that Mormon Doctrine had. But I really don't. The Encyclopedia of Mormonism, that is the closest thing I could think of, and far better book, and of course it has a lot more history, a lot more topics than Mormon Doctrine, but much more balanced set of books. But I just don't think that anyone would attempt it again. I really don't.
Yeah, the Encyclopedia of Mormonism is largely unknown to the average member of the church.
So, as usual.
Yeah.
And that's my point.
Yeah.
See, that's my whole point, is there is no GQ. Well, even McConkie's Messiah series was significant in the way it affected the church. And that's my question. Are we ever going to see that again? It sounds like, Kurt, you're saying no. We're not going to see it.
I think there are books that have, well, one book that has been published that has had impact on the late members of the church is Bushman, Thrush, and Rowland. I mean, there are a number of people, but that book sold almost 150,000 copies. And that wasn't to the average person, walking in Barnes & Noble, saying, geez, I want to go to the Mormons. That was largely to members of the church.
So if you do the math, hang on, six people buying 150,000 copies, that's a lot.
That's pretty good.
but even if you do the math on active membership, that's having a significant penetration in the U.S. So there are potential for non-GA books to have an impact on the general membership. Women in the church, I know that is having an impact on the number of units, and that number of units increases almost daily. It's not uncommon for us to hear stories or get an email about a woman or a man purchasing a half a dozen copies to give to the state presidency and every bishop of the state. So, books like that are actually having an impact, even though most members have heard of it, a lot of the leadership.
But I thought he was asking about encyclopedic work.
Me? No, personally, I want to know if there's ever, anything like that actually penetrates.
Oh, okay. So I thought you meant on that same model as Bukowski. I agree that Bushman's book, it is definitely on my list, just not on this one because of perspective, but that book has been, like many, has been praised and lauded from one end of the country to the other. But surprisingly, to some of you maybe, is that some of Bushman's biggest detractors are in the Seminary and Institute program in the church. And they're not allowed to use it, to reference it. And so it's, but that book is having an impact.
One thing that occurs to me also is that his books like that also create a go-to person for the media. And so when issues come up, the people, they call on those people, and that makes awareness among people who don't necessarily read books. So that's another way the books impact. I think you have to come over here.
Okay.
It's up for our little reach.
Two quick questions, and if this is outside of the purview of the session, feel free to ignore it. I was wondering what sort of influence John Krakauer's book Under the Banner of Heaven has had, aside from maybe the enormous financial reward for this publisher. And then also, are there any books of Mormon literature that have had an impact that you can name?
Well, Well, on Krakauer's book, I think that most of those are purchased by non-Mormons, so an impact on the church, I think, is negligible. Other than, for me, Krakauer's book is a shining example that this church is truly led by inspiration. And the reason I say that is when Krakauer was doing the research for this book, and for those of you who might not be familiar with John, his general genre is, I climbed Mount Everest, everybody died with me. And he's done a number of these books. I'm not sure I keep getting people to still climb with him anymore. But that's his fan base, for people reading these high-adventure, dramatic books about fighting the elements over death. And John got a Venus bonnet to publish about a book about the Lafferty brothers. And if you don't remember the Lafferty brothers, they had been called by God, and most of the rest of us, to start a new church down in Utah County. And as part of that process, it was revealed to them that, I think it was their sister-in-law and her baby, were the Antichrist, and they killed her. And their defense...
Killed them. Them and the baby.
And their defense in court was that God had told them to do this, and so it was okay. Now, just as a little sidebar to show that things are truly... There is a little bit of justice in the criminal system. For a while, one of the Lafferty brothers and Mark Hoffman were cellmates. So he had this religious fanatic and a guy, a self-avowed atheist, trying to destroy a church, sharing a cell. Anyway.
And go back and call them the prophet and the scribe.
Yeah. So Krakauer's book, when it's about to be published, is wanting for an audience. The Mormon studies community know it's been poorly written. John doesn't do a good job of distinguishing between the mother church and these goofballs that have been excommunicated. And so it's not really going to have much appeal in Mormon studies arena. It's not going to have much appeal in the general church at large. So who's going to buy this book? So the publisher was actually struggling to get enough pre-orders before the book was launched to really have the book do anything. And then all indications were it was going to end up on the remainder table in 3 or 4 months in a bucket to a book. Then the day the book is released, Rick Turley held a press conference and said, do not read this book. It's the worst book written about Mormons. Instantly, Amazon becomes number one. Now, clearly, Rick had to be inspired to do that because no rational human being would have done that and given a book that kind of publicity. So I think the book does have that basis of giving us evidence of church deliverance.
Okay, I can't add to the Krakauer part after that, but you asked about some other books that have had impact in Mormon literature. And in our own time, I certainly have to say The Work and the Glory by Gerald Mond. Sold, I don't know how many copies. Chris, do you know how many?
Billions.
Yeah, well, a huge number of sold, and a lot of people thought that was the new history of the church. And I want to go to Nauvoo and see where the Steve family lived. So that, I've never seen such a phenomenon of books that were read. And they were read. They weren't just bought. Like a lot of books, they were read. So that would be a modern phenomenon.
And they were passed around a lot.
Yeah, people shared.
Thanks so much, guys. Do either of you know of the future status of the words of Joseph Smith? The book is sort of indispensable for knowing Joseph Smith's Nauvoo teachings, and it just trying to find a copy, $200, they're just super hard to find. Any word that might be coming out of it?
It's been saying for 25 years that it's nearly finished, the new edition. So I look forward to any time soon, but we're going to try to pressure him to actually get it done. But there was some sensitive material in that, and I think he's been reluctant. But now with a certain recent funeral, that might change.
Would you comment on his place in the pantheon of David O. McKay in the rise of modern Mormonism?
She said, would you comment on its place in the...
Just comment.
On, yeah, of...
That particular book.
Yes.
What was the book?
The David O. McKay.
The Rise of Modern Mormonism. In my opinion, that book is, if not the best, one of the finest biographies ever written about a 20th century Mormon leader, or anyone for that matter. And it is an administrative biography, it's not an entire biography, but Greg Prince and Bob Wright produced an amazing book that will have value for generations to come. And every time I recommend somebody read that book, I've never had anyone come back and say they didn't like it or didn't learn something. It's pretty astounding.
I don't have anything to add.
Any more questions?
Make a comment about Spencer W. Kimball's biography by his son.
Lengthen your stride. Lengthen your stride.
And the CG version, which is surprisingly revealing.
The question is, or the comment is, that we're asking for a comment about Spencer W. Kimball's biography.
This was done by his son, Ed, and again, as an administrative biography. It is one of the most candid, well-written, honest biographies I've ever seen. Very interesting story behind that book, because it's the only book I've ever seen published in the Mormon arena that has what I call dueling introductions, or a foreword, which they call it. But there's an author's and a publisher's, and they agree to disagree about what should have been in there, should not. There's a lot of compromise. But as one of the compromises, Deseret Book agreed to include the entire biography, which was twice again as much as had been published in the printed book, and on a CD, and put it in the back of the book. And we got permission from Ed and from Deseret Book to do a hardcover edition of the entire book that has, on the CD, it has two color inks, so you can see which the original printed version was and what was in the manuscript. And the book was selling pretty well when we did it. It's an expensive book, a big book, out of print, but Peggy stacked it, an article on it, and it just took off. But that is a book I would highly recommend in terms of honesty, candor, and quality.
Thank you. Come on up.
I'll come around.
Yeah. Doesn't reach very far.
Okay, I just had a quick question about historical fiction like that. You brought up the work of the glory. Outside of that, and maybe something like for teenagers with Ten Shoes and the Nephites and stuff, I haven't really seen a lot of Mormon historical fiction have a lot of success. Do you think it's just too small of an audience, or do you think there's enough story there to take? I have to admit, I started writing one, and I kind of got discouraged, like, there's nobody that's going to read this.
Let me just add that we've got a couple more people with questions. We have 7 minutes left. So, in terms of your answer.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about the fiction market in the LDS arena, the follow-up series that Mon did to Mormon and Glory was about the life of Christ, and that did not sell anywhere near. People were excited to read about the stage, but they weren't excited to read about Jesus.
Michael, sorry, go ahead.
That's your question about historical fiction. It really, you've got to remember that the Mormon market, other than certain genre, is a really small market. I mean, it's considered a success if you sell 5,000 copies of the book in the Mormon market. You know, there have been a number of titles that have been historical fiction. You know, I know some of the numbers on Covenant titles, for example. There were a number of historical fiction books that were published that sold 5,000, but nobody's heard of Covenant that it sold 5,000 in print. So, financially, those were a success, but, you know, impacting the larger market non-existent.
Well, remember, we have added on Covenant. published in 1898, published throughout the 20th century, and what did it give us? Saturday's Warrior.
Thank you, gentlemen, for the wonderful panel. Really appreciate it. And I will make a unshameless plug for your bookstore. I'm from Detroit, and I went to Midge Park Books, and it was the haven of restoration studies. I wish I could live there. I think I told you that when I was there. I do have a question for both of you. And Greg Crawford Books, I just recently introduced a few months ago, which I absolutely love them. So, you know, thank you, gentlemen. But I do have a question. What do you both think about John G. Cherner's recent biography on Brigham Young? Since he's a non-Mormon and he's a professor at George Mason, I saw that he got a lot of publicity. I know it's published by Belknap Press, which is kind of like, you know, the more widespread Harvard University Press, and he was featured on C-SPAN, Book TV, and then recently, I think earlier this year, he actually did a whole lesson on early Mormonism, and it was published on C-SPAN again, or publicized. So I'm not really sure what the run count was for the book or how it sold, but it seems to be getting a fairly good response outside the LDS Church. What do you think it's going to be for the LDS Church and outside the LDS Church? Thank you.
John Turner's biography of Brigham Young is, again, in my estimation, one of the finest biographies ever done by a Latter-day Saint leader. John Turner, I would ask people after they read it, could you tell whether he was Mormon or not? Most could not. And he's non-Mormon, and which I think speaks highly of his ability as a historian to be objective. And I don't know the numbers either. I think it's several tens of thousands that have sold. By the way, he has a new book coming out in the near future on Mormon Jesus. I don't know the title, but it's a very important book, award-winning. And but again, the numbers of people who have read it or will read it are probably pretty small overall. That's the problem. But highly recommend.
Final question.
Yeah, you mentioned, both of you, that you were publishing essentially only in English. Do you see any movement to establish for example, a Spanish language LDS publisher? Or are you getting any manuscripts in other languages? Where do we stand there?
We've received a couple of manuscripts in Spanish. Deseret Book does publish a couple of books a year, so there isn't a complete dearth, but the types of books they're publishing are not the types of books that will probably ever be mentioned in a panel like this. Greg Coburn Books is going to make a concerted effort over the next couple of years to start publishing selected titles in Spanish, just as a test to see if there's a market for them. From a humanitarian perspective, the books should all be available in Spanish. But at the end of the day, we've got to make money, and you know, if there's not a market for them, we can't push them. But we're going to give them a try. And, see.
And it is the end of the day, and I would like to make some money. So we please go buy some books.
Thank you all.